Over the past few decades, we've become used to the idea of digital technology racing ahead of us in leaps and bounds. And that's fine as far as it goes. But what about the technology of everything else? When I was a kid, my parents predicted that, well, around about now, passenger space flight would be commonplace, that there would be a base on the moon, that we'd have flying cars and we'd all be living off solar power. But that obviously hasn't happened. Outside the digital world, the material world seems to have just, you know, crept along. Maybe that's about to change. Today, when you want stuff, you go to the shop and buy it, or you order it online. But what if the way this stuff was made was completely different? What if you had a machine in your home that could make this stuff for you at a fraction of the cost that you're paying now? The first generations of these machines are already here and on a million desktops. Guy Rundle is here to talk about this. Guy is currently a correspondent for crikey.com.au. He's also a frequent contributor to various newspapers and journals, and in another life he was a TV producer. Guy has spent much of the past couple of years travelling all over the world to visit the front lines of a revolution in the world of stuff. Guy has glimpsed the implications of 3D printing and robotics, combined with new materials, and he thinks they will affect all of our lives probably for the better. At least that's what he and countless others working on these technologies are hoping for. Guy Rundle's book is called A Revolution in the Making, 3D Printing, Robots and the Future. Hello, Guy.
Hi there, Richard.
You know, I did not think I'd be talking to you about this stuff. Normally you write about politics or culture in Crikey. Why, you're a man of the left as well. Mm-hmm. Why has this stuff caught your attention?
Well, 3D printing started to sort of bubble up into the consciousness of people who are, like many of us are, functional Luddites. A few years ago, I think 2 or 3 years ago, you started to see mentions of it in places like Slate and Salon and those sorts of things. And I got interested, just intrigued by the possibility, did a story for Good Weekend on 3D printing in London. A 3D printer store was opening. And it suddenly occurred to me, as you looked at this stuff, these little printers creating objects from programs without any sort of human moment-to-moment intervention, that this sort of stuff had the potential to change the way we do things, the very fabric of our lives. I mean, I'm not the only one who's thought that, but when you see this stuff, it really hits you and you really understand that something big is going on.
I mentioned there earlier that innovation outside of digital technology and biotechnology seems to have largely stalled. We're still driving cars with internal combustion motors. Jets haven't really improved since the 1970s. What's your view on why progress on all these things that was once rapidly advancing has now stalled for the last few decades?
Well, it's a very complex question, but at the end of the Second World War, we had about two to three decades of Keynesian investment in innovation, state-based funding of capitalism and mixed economies, and a full court press on fusing innovation with production. And that gave us a tremendous leap in the objects around us in everyday life.
You mean like the internet coming out of essentially military, the US
well,
military?
Well, yes, but even things like changes from the motor car being a big chunky sort of late 40s hubcap sort of thing to, you know, a Toyota by the 1970s. Objects became familiar. The TV went from being a huge, or the radiogram went from being a huge box that you had to spend 3 years paying off to being a transistor. Our world filled with objects and our lives changed. And at that point, we had small objects on the one hand, this transformation, and we were going to the moon on the other hand. So we had this world of ever-expanding production, and then we hit a global recession that the Keynesian revolution ran out of oomph.
This was in the 1970s.
Yeah, this is in the 1970s. And in the West, we never really recovered the same degree of transformative power. So in a way, a lot of that intellectual innovation flowed into an easier thing to do, which is to manipulate things digitally, to manipulate information. So it's interesting that as we had that enormous recession, which the West never really recovered from, you know, global physical production moved eastwards, and the West has really sort of stumbled along with a few bubbles and that sort of thing. What we moved into was the computer. So the Apple computer comes along just at the same time as everything else is shutting down, and we all go into the screen, and with that comes an ideology that information will change our lives. Information will change the character of our lives. Meanwhile, yes, we're still driving around in much the same cars, going to the same sort of shops, doing the same sort of things that haven't really changed for decades.
And then along comes something like 3D printing. Mm. Can I just get you to explain what it is and how it's like 2D printing, a normal printer that you have to print something out of the computer?
It was invented about 30 years ago, and it's basically, like, if you imagine a machine that is like a plastic extruder, it's like it's got a flat bed and it's got a nozzle above it. The nozzle moves on an XYZ axis. So it moves across, it moves along, and it moves up and down, or the flat bed moves up and down. And essentially, you connect a computer to this machine, you program it using 3D imaging software, AutoCAD software, the things that architects and people like that use, and you essentially tell the machine how to print out an object, and the machine prints it out by laying down one layer of it at a time. So if we imagine that we tell it to build a small pyramid, it will start by laying out a triangle, a flat triangle, and then it will lay out a slightly smaller triangle on top of that. And layer by layer by layer, it will simply build up a 3D object. And in that sense, we call it 3D printing.
What substance is it extruding to build this thing out
of? It's extruding a polymer, a form of plastic, a long chain molecule form of plastic. So it's related to nylon and that sort of thing. And there's a range of polymers that are used for different modes of printing. So the machine is threaded with a long spool of polymer filament. The machine heats up the polymer as it goes in. So it's a solid spool. It heats up the polymer as it goes in, lays it down, and then there are various different processes by which the plastic is cooled. There's different ways of doing it that have different advantages and disadvantages. You use ultraviolet light, or you use fast cooling, or you use a et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's essentially the way it works.
Now, these 3D printers are called different things. Sometimes they're called makers or maker bots.
Yeah.
What does it cost to buy one to put on your desktop these days, Guy?
The cheapest one you could get is probably running at about $300. So
$300?
Yeah, you could get a very basic one. There's a range of branded sort of very simple machines. These can print out various small objects. The size of what you can print out depends on the size of the bed and the height of the height that the nozzle can go. So,
you know what it reminds me of when I've seen pictures of it? It reminds me of that scene in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where he televises chocolate.
Yeah.
And he gets a bar of chocolate and it suddenly appears on this TV screen.
Yeah.
And then he reaches into it and grabs a fully made bar of chocolate.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like.
Well, there is something magical about it. If you go to, there's a few stores now open in places. In America, there's about half a dozen 3D printing stores where you can go and either buy a 3D printer, or you can order up an object that will be printed in store. A lot of gamers and people like that print up bespoke sort of objects for their games. People print up jewelry and that sort of thing. So a lot of it is trinkets at the moment. But you know, I printed up a little clip for my laptop. I got someone to do it. I got a standard design off the internet, and I modified it to fit a specific rare type of laptop I had.
So this is the key. You can customize the
absolutely. Yeah, you can customize, and you also don't have to spend, you know, this was the great liberation for me. You don't have to spend hours in Officeworks or somewhere like that, or stationery stores looking for little objects.
That are exactly right.
And really, this object was just done for free because the cost of the plastic was approaching zero.
Now, you mentioned there that this process of construction that these makers use is called additive. What do you mean by that, and how is that different from standard manufacturing?
Basically, when you think of standard manufacturing, especially when you're making a prototype, is subtractive. You get a block of wood, a block of metal, that sort of thing, and you carve away or weld away, melt away, until you get the object. Additive manufacturing creates the object from raw material by adding it together. And this is very important in the other type of 3D printing, which is metal-based, which is still industrial, which is called sintering. And this is where you take metal powder, usually titanium, and using lasers, you fuse the molecules of the metal powder together and you get a solid metal object. This has revolutionized especially prototyping over the last 20 years. So the reason why product design gets faster, product design gets more modular, the reason our cars sort of change shape and form and new engines come out and that sort of thing is because we've been able to do this sort of prototyping. So rather than taking a block of titanium, getting rid of 80% of it in order to get one solid motor part, you can build it up from titanium powder, which is a fraction of the cost.
So there's not a bit of waste then?
Yeah,
There's not scrap afterwards?
No, there's no scrap. And really, the titanium powder is often from scrap where it's been taken from other subtractive processes. So you've got this virtuous cycle of that sort of production.
The most significant moment, it seems, from reading your book, Guy, is something called the RepRap machine.
Yep.
Can you explain what the RepRap machine is?
Yes, the RepRap is the basis of most of the 3D printing, the commercially available simple 3D printers we have now. It's essentially a 3D printer that can print out a copy of itself, or most of itself.
A 3D printer that can copy itself.
Yes. What a RepRap looks like is basically a sort of a skeletal sort of structure. It's a series of, if you imagine a cube, an open cube with the lines of the cube being metal bars, put together with plastic printed out components and with a moving nozzle and a flatbed, as I described earlier. This is a printer that was invented by an English engineer named Adrian Bowyer in the mid-2000s. And what he wanted was to liberate the 3D printer, which was well known to engineers by that time, from the sort of the closed circle of manufacturing, where the 3D printer was being used to prototype objects that would then be mass-produced and sold. What Bowyer and others wanted to do with this RepRap, which is a sort of replicating rapid prototyper, that's where the name comes from, is to create a printer that can print itself and thus print innumerable copies of itself and also print everyday objects that one could use, whether in a modern society or in a developing society or in a very poor society, and thus reduce the cost of producing thousands of objects to something approaching zero. So they worked on that for about 3 years with a rolling blog, which is a fascinating process. Produced the first one in about 2008, and it's all open source. So it's all a shared code, shared development. There's no patenting. It's all an ongoing mass project involving thousands of people now.
So the dream behind this then is mass ownership of a 3D printer then.
Yeah,
if you've got a RepRap, then that's something that can make a copy or most of a copy of itself.
Yeah.
Does that then make the actual dollar value of each RepRap machine very, very low as a
that's
result?
That's right. But what you want is, I mean, Bowyer is one of these British engineers who are formed by the sort of the social movements of post-war Britain, where a lot of engineers saw themselves as part of a socialist society, a society that was transitioning into something post-capitalist. So this is not just a nuts and bolts guy. This is someone who's thought a lot about how you can create mass social change. And the idea is, yes, that the more printers you have, the cheaper everything gets. So these printers obviously print exponentially. They spread out at the same time as they're printing out simple objects, cups, forks, spoons, knives, plates, household objects, DIY, anything you can think of is conceivably capable of being done with these machines.
Well, here's the thing, though. When you get excited by the promise of a 3D printer, and then you see the kinds of things that you can make on your basic household one, and they're pretty trivial things most of the time. They're little figurines, little statues, paper clips, like you say, that kind of thing. I've seen one make a paper knife, and it wasn't that great.
Yeah.
Who's to say it's going to do any better than that? It's kind of disappointing when you see the kind of really boring, low-grade stuff it can make.
Yeah, this is interesting what's happening in that the trinket stage of the of the technology has preceded the useful stage. And this is frequently a disappointment that people have, that, you know, they see these little knickknacks being produced, and there are websites where you can order, you know, 3D printed unique jewellery and that sort of thing. But the real promise of 3D printing as a transformation of life is still coming slowly. Now, that's related to various things. 3D printers are still a little slow. The non-industrial models, the industrial models, which cost $1 million or two, move pretty fast these days. But these 3D printers still lay down one layer at a time pretty slowly. They're getting better at being sort of set and forget machines, but sometimes they still jam, or they will squeeze out a gloop of polymer that's too big and you have to, you know, reshape it, that sort of thing. So we're on this sort of curve whereby speed and accuracy are increasing, but also size. So at the moment, you know, you have these desktop printers which can print out objects about 10 centimetres by 10 centimetres by 10 centimetres. And now we're getting to things like the Gigabot, which can print out objects a metre by a metre by a metre. And another one I just saw in Germany a couple of months ago, which is 1.6 by 1.6 metres. So then you're getting to stuff that can print out furniture.
This is where I started to get excited. Yeah. It's when I started to put the idea of a 3D printer next to something like IKEA. What would it mean if you had a 3D printer in your home that could print out all the components of an item of furniture that you then assembled in your home, rather than having a gigantic 3D printer to make a whole chair, the components of a chair that you then assembled?
Well, you could do both. The costs of these machines will come down. The Gigabot is running at about $10,000, I think, at the moment. And it's really just a large version of a RepRap. So the costs will come down and come down. And eventually the RepRap idea was that everybody would have one in their garage. And you would be able to either print out the individual components of a chair to fit together, or a desk or whatever, or you can just print it out as one unit. Or you could have, increasingly what they're doing is combining 3D printers with another type of machine called a CNC router, which is a cutting and shaping machine tool. Essentially, when you have those two components in one, you can automatically produce a quite finely machined object simply by plugging in a file that you get off the internet. So you wouldn't have to have any expertise. The machine will just do it for you.
You've been all over the world, to various places all around the world, to see where this future in 3D printing is being invented in all sorts of different ways. Talk about the places you went to, the kinds of cities they are and towns that they are, where the future is being invented here.
A lot of this is former great manufacturing areas, places like Buffalo and Michigan in the States, Coventry in the UK, and the old Ruhr Valley in Germany.
Places with empty factories, in other words.
It's places with empty factories and a manufacturing tradition. In Europe and the UK, it's places where the state has invested in advanced manufacturing. In the US, more interestingly, it's places where the government has basically abandoned the area. You know, that the swathe of the Northern Rust Belt are places which have just rotted for 25 years. And there's a certain amount of make-do and can-do sort of experimentation with objects. These are mechanical engineers, people who like stuff and things and were never attracted by disappearing into a screen.
So. You mentioned Buffalo, New York there, which is about the furthermost point away from New York City as it can be in the state of New York.
Yeah.
It's part of that old Rust Belt. It's an old Rust Belt city. What did you see there? What was going on there?
I went to Buffalo because I saw a story about a father and son team who were experimenting with metal 3D printing that would be consumable at an individual level, that you'd be able to buy a printer that printed 3D metal as an individual. This is a family called the Vader family. They have their name goes back generations, so George Lucas can't sue them when their logo says Vader Systems. The dad is a guy who's an engineer for 30 years for a Canadian truck company and a very innovative guy and a good manager. And his son, who is a bit of a genius, who had been inventing really since he was about 16 and just problem solving, inventing, you know, inline rollerblades that mimicked the actions of ice skates using electromagnetics and that sort of thing. He had gone through about three different inventions trying to find, you know, experimenting with something and putting it down. And he transferred this interest in electromagnetics to metal 3D printing. The problem with metal 3D printing is that you have to heat the metal in order to deposit it in the way that 3D printing works. But as soon as you heat the metal, you then have a whole series of transport problems of how do you get the metal to the deposition.
Gets clogged in the nozzle or something,
yeah,
does it?
Yeah, it gets clogged in the nozzle, or you have to have very expensive equipment to stop it, you know, catching fire. And when you lay the metal down, molecularly speaking, metal is different to polymer. So you have a lot more complexity in terms of the layers of metal and the strength and weakness.
So how did he get around it?
Well, he used electromagnetics, so the metal doesn't actually touch the tube it's going through at any point, which is brilliant, you know. And they've been developing prototype after prototype. They were getting ready for, you know, to get some investors in, or simply to just start with an industrial model and then try and scale down, back down to the consumer model.
What can you do with a rapid-fire 3D printer that uses molten metal?
Well, you could actually start to make anything. I mean, you could make car parts, you could make machine parts. When you think about it, what you could have is eventually a world of modular mechanical objects, a washing machine that rather than having to go and find a part for it or get someone in to do it, you would just know which part needed replacing, print it out and slot it in.
Oh, you could make a hammer, a screwdriver, a whole bunch of tools, stuff you normally go down to the hardware shop for.
Absolutely. This is really the transformation that one would be looking at. There are other materials that you can also use for 3D printing now. There's synthetic wood, synthetic ceramics, and increasingly these are becoming improving in quality, so that with synthetic ceramics, you really can't tell the difference between a vase, printed out vase, and a reasonably good sort of shop model.
The revelation here is that all across the United States and in Australia to a lesser degree, there are these places popping up called makerspaces, which are using and experimenting with 3D technology and other technologies as well to see how far they can push the technologies. What are these makerspaces? Tell me a bit about them.
Typically, they're a workshop with a variety of different tools. People start them either a collective starts them up in some factory, abandoned factory or garage they rent out, or a smaller group starts them out and then offers memberships, like you'd have a membership to a library or something like that. And increasingly, they effectively run as a fusion between computer hacking, between craft spaces, between technical making. They arose mainly in the States about 10 years ago from hackerspaces. Hackerspaces were places where computer hackers had created gathering spaces because they were starting to feel isolated and atomized. Now, a certain amount of hackers tend to work at the metal level. That is, they solder their own motherboards and parts in and that sort of thing. They have a certain amount of technical skills. And as 3D printing developed, as the RepRap started to expand, people started to get interested in that. They became interested in welding. The idea of going back to tools and materiality started to take off as part of the counterculture. And that's where these makerspaces have come from. They're hobbyists, but they're also very political and very socially minded.
They tend to share a determination to, quote, open the black boxes. What do they mean by that? What are the black boxes?
Well, the black box is an idea that we go around and we have for about 50 years, not knowing how our technology works. Right up until the 1960s, most people knew how to take their cars apart to a degree. They knew how to do their own repairs. Most people knew how to repair a lot of stuff in their kitchen and that sort of thing. So when you have that, you have an understanding of the world and the way it's put together. And gradually, as production was globally outsourced, as it became cheaper to throw something away than have it repaired, these things became mysterious to us and we became disabled within our own world to the point where we're just incapable.
I know you and I are roughly of the same generation. I think I can't figure out how to make any of these things. I've got no skill. I know how to use them, of course, like you do. But how they work is a mystery to me. Is it a mystery to you as well?
It was. It's becoming less of a mystery. I mean, the more I get into this, the more I sort of start to challenge my own, you know, luddism, my own sort of nervousness before technology.
As the factory down the road has closed down and the labour for it is, you know, the production of whatever it is has gone offshore down to China or India or Bangladesh, that's distanced us even further from the production of things too, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, the way our cities have been transformed. Cities used to be places where you could see production, you could see factories, you could see workshops, you walked past them every day. And really in the last 20 years, these factories have all either been pulled down or turned into apartments, which are then named after the factory that they used to be, you know, the old smeltery or apartments or that sort of thing. The cities have become black boxes because they have no content. You know, there is no visibility of material production.
On air, online and podcast, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Guest today is Guy Rundle. Guy is a correspondent for crikey.com.au. A couple of years ago, Guy became aware of new technologies in the making along the lines of 3D printing, robotics, and new materials as well. And the more he looked into it, the more he realized that these things contain with them a very powerful promise, and that is the promise to overturn the way we make things and the way we buy things, if indeed we buy things at all in the future. He went out to Michigan, another one of these industrial Rust Belt places in the United States, kind of grim, full of dead factories. And again, there's another makerspace going on in there, Guy. This is a group of people trying to make self-powered 3D printers. Tell me about these people.
Yeah, this is a combined makerspace and university research group. It's called the Pierce Research Group. And Joshua Pierce is an engineer who's worked in Canada and America and now has a team around him who are experimenting with creating complexes of technology that can radically challenge developing world problems of things like water supply, food production, and that sort of thing. What they want to do is use the RepRap printing technology to create a printer that prints itself out, but is solar powered and prints out its own solar cells or the solar cells for the next printer. And then also...
Hang on, just stop there for a second. Yeah. A 3D printer that makes copies of itself and then also prints its own batteries out? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly. You'll be printing out your own... Eventually, you'll be printing out your own solar cells, your own batteries. You'll come along with one printer and it will print out all the parts it needs. And the raw material that's going in is waste.
What kind of waste?
Well, plastic waste. You know, we have an enormous... a plethora, especially in the developing world or the non-developing world, of plastic waste. Because in the 1980s, one of the things that happened with globalization was that they were persuaded to take first world waste as a service in order to reduce their debts. And that's why you see these pictures in India and Africa of these massive landfills, acre after acre after acre of plastic, dead plastic. One of Joshua Pierce's arguments is that you look at these rag pickers and these people eking out a living on these smouldering waste things. All you could do is take a printer there, start printing out printers, and people could then use the waste to print out objects.
How much progress have they made turning waste into objects? Literally. Have they been able to literally get plastic waste and turn it into something?
Yeah, absolutely. They've been cutting up plastic milk cartons, soft drink bottles and that sort of thing. They've developed various machines to shred it so that it is then sort of rewoven into filament and then fed through into the printer. The problem with this is that you lose some quality of finesse if you use that sort of plastic. You lose about 40% of the tolerance, but that's fine for simple objects. So they're now experimenting with something like a water filter, for example. You know, 5 million children a year die from contaminated water every year. Now, for decades, we've campaigned about, you know, for the cost of one fighter jet, that sort of thing, we could do this and this and this. Nothing happens. We chip away at the problem. It would be great if we could just bypass all that and just print out water filters. So they're working on a water filter that could be printed out from this sort of waste plastic and then printed out for cents at a time. They're working on not only putting it in a suitcase, but making it small enough to put in carry-on luggage. So at that point, you would just get on a plane. with one of these machines, and you'd just go somewhere and start printing it out. So it would be a radical way of addressing that sort of global imbalance.
So the dream then is to have something in a suitcase, really, yeah, that you then get on a plane, you go to somewhere like some garbage heap, yeah, in the Philippines or Africa or, yeah, somewhere like that, pull out a maker, a 3D printer, yeah, make some copies of itself,
yeah,
and then use that to make water filters to, and use the existing garbage mountain that's there.
And to train people how to use it, because you're then helping people to skill up in a way that allows them to have an interrelationship with technology. You then have very simple computers. Eventually, we'll be able to print out circuit boards using metal inks, and you know, that's on the way too. And then you'd just be able to assemble a very simple computer. So you're at the ground level, you're changing the relationship to technology. Pierce is a very interesting guy. He's a scientist with two PhDs, but he's also from a left Catholic sort of tradition. So a lot of his thinking is about that you should always try and address problems at the level they occur, rather than trying to overwhelm or to try to do things from the top down.
Top down, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, a maker can make all kinds of things. It can make a water filter, but now they can also make a gun. Some guys actually tried to make a gun with a 3D printer and succeeded in doing that. And there's been a lot of media attention on that. What do you make of that guy?
Oh, that was Cody Wilson, I think his name is, he's a libertarian from the South, and he printed out a gun, was it last year? Which, you know, after about 300 attempts, he got it to fire without actually blowing up, and then took a few shots actually holding it. But most of the other tests he'd done with a remote control. And this, of course, was the story that raced around the world. Now, the first thing to say is, the last thing there's a shortage of in America is guns. So there was something, you can just go to a gun show and buy pretty much whatever you need.
So why would you bother making a thing that's going to explode in your hand when you can just go and buy one really quickly and easily?
He runs a thing called distributed defense. This is a very American, or a certain strand of American libertarianism, which is about defending a closed community. You know, the idea that you have to defend yourself against the state or against your enemies. That is a way of democratizing the means of aggression or defense, if you like. It's not something I'm hugely in favor of. It's not something I'm hugely against. But it's interesting that what happened was that the new global media latched onto that as the representative of 3D printing. In other words, rather than latching onto all these stories we've just been talking about, it's incredible things people are doing all across the world. They latched onto the one object of fear, the one idea of 3D printing as threat.
I suppose it does illustrate the larger point, though. You can make whatever you like. And people being people will do nice things, and they'll do some things that are not so nice for the technology.
And this is one of the issues in this, in the new world of technology that is coming, whether we like it or not, that we have these different streams of new technology. 3D printing and additive manufacturing are one, robotics are another, nanotechnologies are another. These all bring with them their own opportunities and threats. But it seems to me that 3D printing, additive manufacturing, is the one that is the most capable of democratizing production.
What do you like most about 3D printing, Guy?
What I'm interested in is what you raised at the start of this, that things haven't changed much in terms of the economic framework we find ourselves in. We're still going to shops. We're still paying enormous amounts of money for very simple objects from very high wages, which then get consumed by the objects we have to buy. That's on the one hand in the advanced world. On the other hand, in the developing and non-developing world, we have this absolute starvation of basic technology, this absolute drought of capital for that sort of thing. 3D printing seems to me to address both these problems as the same problem. It would ideally liberate us and offer people an opportunity to get out of the cash cycle if they wanted to, if they wanted to have a life where a lot of their objects were simple objects printed out at virtually no cost, and they freed up their time to do something else. It offers that opportunity, right up to the level of 3D printing houses, which they're doing in places like Loughborough in England, and they're doing in China. You have these enormous machines that basically 3D print out a house on a
specific, house.
A house. There's two ways of doing it. One is to have a machine that is the size of a house and is an XY axis and prints out the house from the ground up. The other one is like an enormous rotor arm which prints out these houses which look like sort of pod-like structures.
What, like a series of plates that interconnect or bricks that interconnect? Is it Lego, essentially?
No. These are all in one object. Not only that, but you can program it with multiple materials, so you can print in the plumbing and you can print in the electrical circuitry into the walls as you go. So the house is printed all in one go. It just rises up, and then at some level the printer puts in a pipe, and at some level it puts in an electrical circuit. China's doing them in batches of a dozen at the moment. So China is really racing forward on this stuff. So, yeah, 3D printing replication in this sense is a new mode of production, and it is worth seizing on for people who are interested in the idea of human liberation, in the idea of a genuine human material freedom.
So as a man from the left, then, do you see this as essentially, you know, like the old dream of workers controlling the means of production, or essentially like consumers controlling the means of production, really, or citizens controlling the means of production?
People. I mean, it breaks down the consumer-producer divide, but it also does it in a way that gets around some of the more romantic ideas of breaking down that divide. For a couple of hundred years since the emergence of the left, we've had two trends. One has been the trend taken over by Marxism, which has been to say, we'll keep driving technology forward, we'll tunnel through capitalism, and eventually we'll get to a control of production. And the other one has been the sort of the romantic William Morris trend, which has said that industrialism is terrible and we've got to get back to handicrafts and making things ourselves and that sort of thing. Now, the Marxist trend has hit an impasse because we can't get beyond this net of capitalism and this cycle of desires and spending and overpricing and that sort of thing. And the romantic one, the countercultural one, I think has finally run out of steam. I think there's always going to be a section of people in the community who want to do that sort of stuff, who want to make their own stuff. But the William Morris idea that we'll all be in smocks, sort of knitting our own cars and that sort of thing, I think that's gone. And I think that has been the cause of a lot of sort of failure of an ability to transform. So what we have with 3D printing and other related technologies is the ability to have low-cost, approaching zero-cost printing. This is not something you would have to spend a lot of attention on. This is not something you'd have to sort of learn a new skill.
So the idea is the 3D printer is a bit of a set and forget. You know, you say, yeah. I need, at the moment you could say, I need a hammer, and then come home at the end of the day and it'd be there. So it holds out the hope of us getting out of the cycle of working in a bad job in order to have enough money to pay for things which we might just print out at home.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing is we might not have that job with the 3D printer because all those, you can see a whole lot of jobs shutting down as a result.
I mean, this is the other side of this, and this is the other side of this with robotics. We are definitely approaching a radical shift in employment patterns and the non-replacement of old jobs by new jobs. For about 30 years, we had this process whereby, or, you know, 100 years, we had this process whereby agricultural jobs were replaced by industrial jobs, and then industrial jobs were replaced by service jobs, and then service jobs were replaced by cultural jobs. And every time we've done that, there's been a smaller yield of new jobs and a lot of hidden unemployment and underemployment. So really in the West, we really have about 15 to 20% unemployment, underemployment, and we've had that for a couple of decades. And in the next 10 to 15 years, we're going to fall off a cliff. Everything that can be automated is going to start to be automated. And I'm amazed that people haven't realised this. I'm amazed that people haven't looked around and seen what the things that can be done by machines that are currently being done by humans.
Yeah, bookshops are disappearing, music shops are disappearing.
But even things like, think of the supermarket. You know, 3 to 4 years ago, a job went that had been not a great job, but a job that hundreds of thousands of people had relied on for decades.
Which the checkout chick.
The checkout chick. Yeah. It just went in 12 months. It went, it has never come back.
On Qantas flights, I don't have any human issuing me with a boarding pass or checking my luggage in now.
And McDonald's and other fast food outlets are now experimenting with shops which only have backroom staff. So you just plug your order into a machine. And as you can, you know, you're standing there in a fast food shop and you're going, well, why do I actually need to tell this person to plug in this machine? Eventually, you just order it from your smartphone. And that will happen to coffee shops. That will happen to chain stores. Then it'll start to go up to, or it is starting to go up to second level jobs that require some sort of determination of skill. And this is all the product of Moore's Law, the law that computing power doubles in power and halves in price around every 18 months. So it has expanded exponentially. And that's where you're starting to get these machines that can really replace what used to be autonomous jobs.
So how does this play out, Guy? I mean, if there's going to be greater automation, on the one hand, destroying whole job categories,
yeah,
it seems we'll need these 3D printers, won't we? Because we won't have a job to earn the money in order to actually buy things anymore.
We are going to have to change the whole macro structure of the economy and society. There's not going to be a choice about it anymore. It's not going to be a debate between capitalists and socialists in moral terms. It is simply that the only way in which the framework we have now of capitalism, in which almost everything you do is bought and sold as a black box product, the only way that that could be kept going would be to keep inventing masses of new commodified needs, desires, occupations, that sort of thing. Now, the people who think that capitalism is an eternal structure and has always been there presume that that will happen, that as you no longer have the slurry worker or the fast food person or the checkout chick or the, you know, the auto mechanic in the old style, that you get more wedding planners, masseurs,
radio presenters.
Yeah, and it's not happening that way, and it's not going to happen that way. Job replacement by moving from one sector to another was a stage in human history, and we are starting to approach the point at which that will no longer be possible.
What makes you so sure, Guy? I mean, and you mentioned Karl Marx before. Karl Marx made some pretty confident predictions in the 19th century. One was that there'd be working class revolutions across the advanced European economies. This would lead to a dictatorship of the proletariat, and then that it all break down into perfect communism, which would be these anarchic communes where people would get along just fine and, you know, knit their own cars, as you say. That didn't happen. There are dangers in making these confident predictions about the future, whether you're in favour of them or not, aren't they, Guy?
What we are seeing now is unquestionably a crisis of profit and a crisis of production and a crisis of accumulation starting to emerge as automation takes over. Because if you do a thought experiment and you imagine a totally automated society, impossible, but imagine a totally automated society, you have to ask yourself, where would the profit come from? The only way the profit would come is if you gave everybody a grant of a certain amount of money and they then spent that at this totally automated factory. This is what we're approaching. That's the sort of the hidden mechanism behind what you might call the job apocalypse, that we're not going to get this replacement of these old jobs by new jobs. That was always the way in which a profit crisis was deferred. We created new forms of jobs. But you then run into a problems of time and space. There's only so many hours in a day that you can consume.
I don't know. It seems to me like when you get to the end of your book here, you seem to be arguing with yourself. And on the one hand, you say, look, it can be unwise to make confident predictions about the future because whole things come into play in the future that we just don't see coming. And, you know, the great example of that is with Blade Runner, where we saw in the future that phones would have screens on them, but they'd still be attached to the wall. You know,
yeah.
That wasn't right at all. So you say this on the one hand, we need to be sceptical about where technology is taking us. But on the other hand, you seem to be also saying, God, I hope this is true. God, I hope this happens. What's your fondest hope for this, the transformative power of this new technology?
The fondest hope is that we have, as I said, a positive and a negative channel to these technologies. The positive channel is mostly with 3D printing. Some of it is with, like, citizen robotics, if you like, creating small modular robots that can do stuff. All this stuff distributes technology. It distributes technological know-how. It's all based on open source sharing of information and collective development. And the idea is to create a time-rich society where people who don't want to work 40, 60 hours a week but want a different sort of life can have it without it being a hair shirt sort of ascetic lifestyle. The negative side is invested largely in things like military robotics, nanotechnology, which requires very specialized knowledge and can be used as forms of control, as forms of surveillance, as forms of state violence and that sort of thing. In order to have a better world, in order to have materially democratic world, we're going to have control of these technologies, and we should start now in order to understand these technologies. If we don't, then the other possibility is a sort of post-democratic sort of dictatorship in which things are held in a sort of stasis using robots, using surveillance, using nanotechnology as forms of total control.
What are you hoping that 3D printing and robots might liberate us from? Is it work? Because most people like to work, don't they? I mean, most people find validation from their work and a sense of usefulness and worth in the world.
People find mixture. I mean, if you look at the Gallup studies on work satisfaction, it's actually quite low. 70% of people say that they're dissatisfied with their job and wouldn't do it if they didn't have to. And, you know, people like you and I have meaningful labour. A lot of people don't. You know, the Monday morning blues are a generally understood phenomenon because most people want useful activity in the world, but they don't want the sort of work that most people have, which is repetitive, dominated, segmented and liberated.
Yeah, I think Monday morning blues are pretty bad when you've got a job you don't want to go to, but they're even worse when you have no job at all.
Yeah, exactly. But what we want is a liberation of human activity. You know, we have a society that is fantastically productive, 16, 20, 24 times more productive than it was 50 years ago, yet we still have a 40-hour week. Now, how is it that the work week changed from 60 hours a week in the 1870s to 40 hours a week by the 1950s, yet it hasn't budged an inch?
Some people would say that's because we want to work. The reason we complain about the amount of work we do is hypocrisy, because actually we must want to do it.
Where do we get the choice? I mean, this is the thing. We don't have a modular society where you can reasonably choose to work 20 hours a week and have the security of long-term employment and that sort of thing. At the moment, you're faced with the invidious choice that if you want security, superannuation, career path, that sort of thing, you have to commit to 40 hours, 50 hours, 60 hours a week. And people then compensate for that by consuming material products. Now, if people want to do that, that's great, that's fine. But we're not offered the choice. And there's something weird about the fact that people for a century actively chose for a reduction in the working week, and then for half a century haven't chosen it at all. They were never offered the choice. In Sweden now, they're experimenting with a six-hour workday. They've had it like a seven-and-a-half-hour workday for ages where, you know, people in Sweden are out on the streets by 3 p.m. They have the whole other half of the day free. There doesn't seem to be any reason why we can't have a prosperous society with a 20-hour work week. But we're going to have some macro changes in terms of GDP and that sort of thing. And that's where these new technologies come in, because they get us out of that cycle without obliging us to be ascetic.
What you're hoping for is that 3D printers that are able to self-replicate will mean that the cost of them goes right down to almost nothing, essentially.
Yeah.
Therefore, that just takes any profit out of the whole process.
Yeah.
And therefore, that money becomes a lot less, or cash becomes a lot less meaningful when you can make most of the things you want and need for almost nothing at all.
Yeah.
But who's to say this whole thing, this whole phenomenon, won't just somehow be absorbed into the belly of this the global capitalist system that's already there? There's plenty of venture capitalists, I'm sure, who are probably coming into the meetings straight after you when you went into these places, who are waiting for the next Facebook, waiting for the next biotech breakthrough, and they might see it here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of stuff that's happened following RepRap has been sort of branded things like, so MakerBot, which is the main 3D printer company running 3D stores, is a RepRap version developed in a makerspace in Brooklyn and then branded.
Yeah, they want to be kind of like the Apple Macintosh of the 3D printer world, don't they?
So it's a site of struggle. But what it offers, and it offers it in the same way and in a much more comprehensive way as the online revolution offered in terms of music and films and that sort of thing. It ideally liberates you from having to go to a commodified market for the basic things you need.
You could be published on the internet without having to go to a publisher. Yeah. You can create music without having to go into a recording studio. You know, this is what we can do.
And this creates all sorts of problems, and we know that this has created, you know, problems in terms of having a career in music or having a career in this or having a career in that. But look, these things are happening. These technologies are racing forward. So the brute fact of the technology at the base level will transform the way we live. And as you say, the cash economy always has a very powerful capacity to draw these things back in.
Yeah, because people like money. People like money. That's a kind of a truism.
Well, people like what money gets them, which is things of their desires. Now, if you can get the things of your desires without money, or in a look, you can imagine in 20 years' time that you would be a member, say, of some sort of depot, if you like, which made stuff to order. So you needed a new piece of furniture, you would select it from the computer, you would plug it in and send it down online to this depot, and it would be almost automatically produced. And maybe you'd just pay, you know, a certain fee per month or something like that, in the same way you pay a gym membership at the moment. Now, there are all sorts of problems, I agree, with the intersection that you would then have between different levels of the economy, between cash economy and this new free economy and that sort of thing. That would all have to be worked out as we go in practice. But one way or another, it's going to happen. The only way in which this sort of degree of zero-cost production would be kept out of the hands of people would be by the very, very concerted and brutal opposition of the current powers that be.
Can we make an agreement here to meet again in 10 years' time to revisit this conversation? I guarantee what you and I will be saying was, we'll be talking about something and we'll be saying, well, we didn't see that coming,
yeah,
10
absolutely.
Years ago.
Absolutely. You never see, yes, I agree. Yes, I'm happy to do that. And we will probably have printed out the microphones ourselves.
Yeah, all upload our consciousnesses into robots and we'll let them have that conversation.
Well, that's the future I don't want to see. I want the truly human future, you know, where the objects are zero cost and produced and humans are more human than they were, not machines.
Rundlebot, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you for downloading this podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.